This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, Nigerian troops fight off Boko Haram militants in the northeastern state capital. President Obama begins a visit to India by announcing major progress toward a civilian nuclear deal. And the World Health Organization meets to consider how to improve its response to Ebola-like disease outbreaks. I'm Michael Lippin. Nigerian officials say government troops repelled several attempts by Boko Haram militants to enter the northeastern town of Maiduguri on Sunday. A Nigerian soldier at the scene told VOA that there were many dead on both sides. The Islamist Boko Haram group has killed thousands of people in Nigeria's northeast and controls much of Borno State. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry reiterated U.S. support for Nigeria's battle against the militants on a visit to the capital, Lagos.
The principal reasons that President Obama asked me to come here at this moment is to reinforce to all Nigerians the desire of the United States to be able to engage even more so in the effort to push back against Boko Haram or any other violent extremist group.
Mr. Kerry also met the two leading candidates in Nigeria's presidential election next month, the incumbent president, Goodluck Jonathan, and the main opposition candidate, Muhammadu Buhari. The top U.S. diplomat called for the February 14th vote to be conducted peacefully and credibly and said anyone who engages in election violence will not be welcome in the United States. U.S. President Barack Obama says he and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi have reached a breakthrough in negotiations for a long-awaited nuclear power deal. Mr. Obama was speaking after arriving Sunday in New Delhi, where he will be the first U.S. president to attend India's Republic Day celebration. The United States signed a deal in 2008 to provide India with civilian nuclear technology. But implementation had stalled due to disagreements about an Indian law that imposes liabilities on makers of civilian nuclear equipment in case of accidents. On Sunday, both nations agreed to set up a multi-million dollar insurance pool that does not force India to change its laws. Well, U.S. President Obama has issued a new warning to Moscow after Ukrainian pro-Russian separatists attacked the Ukrainian port of Mariupol on Saturday, killing at least 30 people. VOA's Michael Bowman has more.
Devastation in Mariupol after a rebel rocket bombardment prompted sharp comments by President Obama on a visit to India.
We are deeply concerned about the latest break in the ceasefire and the aggression that these separatists, with Russian backing, Russian equipment, Russian financing, Russian training, and Russian troops, are conducting. And we will continue to take the approach that we've taken in the past, which is to ratchet up the pressure on Russia.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko was even more blunt, blaming the attack on terrorists supported by Russia.
Понеділок, завтра.
On Monday, there should be a meeting of EU foreign ministers where we will coordinate further steps to provide for the security of Ukraine and increase pressure on the Russian Federation.
Russia denies involvement in the Ukrainian conflict and blames Kiev for the peace accord's failure to halt bloodshed. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
In Egypt, at least 15 people were killed on Sunday as protesters marked the anniversary of a deadly 2011 uprising that ousted longtime leader Hosni Mubarak. Egyptian media report dozens more were injured in clashes between security forces and demonstrators in Cairo and at least two other cities. Most of the deaths were in Cairo's Matariya district, an Islamist stronghold where police confronted supporters of the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. Pakistan's military says it has bombed suspected militant hideouts in the North Waziristan tribal region, killing at least 35 militants. The army says Sunday's airstrikes focused on the Data Kail area near the Afghan border. Foreign fighters were said to be among those killed. Pakistan's military has been carrying out a major counterterrorism offensive in the Waziristan region since June. Pakistani officials say the attacks have killed government attacks have killed around 2,000 suspected militants. Fighting between Philippine police and Muslim rebels has killed at least 30 people in the southern Philippines, where rebels signed a long-awaited peace deal with the government last year. The battle took place on Sunday when police encountered fighters from the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, with local officials saying police suffered most of the casualties. The fighting subsided after ceasefire monitors intervened to try to separate the two sides and calm the situation. The World Health Organization has admitted that it was too slow in tackling the Ebola crisis in West Africa, enabling the epidemic to spiral out of control. Health experts from around the world are debating measures to reform the agency's response to the global public health emergencies in a special one-day session on Ebola. Lisa Schlein reports from the WHO headquarters in Geneva.
UN Special Envoy on Ebola, David Nabarro, says the UN system must be prepared to respond quickly and basic public health techniques must be adopted.
My experience to date tells me that for responses to have the greatest chance of success, they must be strategic, strong and speedy. They must be based on prearranged roles and responsibilities, and they must use already established systems.
Dr. Nabarro says local communities must be at the center of response to a health emergency. National authorities in charge of this response and coordination is vital to international efforts to get on top of a pandemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Greece's anti-austerity Syriza party and its leader Alexis Tsipras appear headed to a decisive national election victory in a vote that followed repeated European demands for fiscal restraint in Athens. Early vote counting on Sunday night showed that Syriza with about 35% of the vote, outpacing the 29% recorded by the conservative New Democracy Party led by incumbent Greek Prime Minister Antonis Samaras. Official projections say the final margin could be wider. And in Zambia, Edgar Lungu has been sworn in as the country's sixth president after narrowly winning a vote that was rejected by the opposition. The Election Commission said Mr. Lungu of the ruling Patriotic Front won 48.3% of the vote. His rival, Hakainde Hichilema of the United Party for National Development, finished second with 46.7%. Hichilema alleges that the election, which ended Saturday, was stolen and does not reflect the will of the Zambian people. Voting began on January 20th, but was extended because of heavy rains. Well, that's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Michael Lippin. Bye for now.
This is Business News on VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson. Hundreds of people have protested in Romania against high repayments for Swiss franc loans, blaming the banks for offering deceptively cheap loans and calling on the government to regulate hard currency loans. "The bank tricked us," yelled 1,000 demonstrators gathered in a downtown square. About 75,000 Romanians have loans in Swiss francs, taking them out during the economic boom of the mid-2000s because they had a lower interest rate. They've now been hit by a strong franc, and even more so after the Swiss National Bank abolished its currency ceiling this month, causing the franc to increase by 40% against the euro. Lawmakers are discussing implementing rules to protect people who take out hard currency loans. Officials say the parent company of British Airways has made a third improved takeover approach to Irish airliner Aer Lingus, and an announcement of the offer is expected later Monday. The $2.80 share offer by IAG values the Dublin-based carrier at $1.45 billion. Over the past month, Aer Lingus has rejected two lower-price proposals from IAG, created in 2009 by the merger of British Airways and Spanish airliner Iberia. Ford Motor Company is removing its Venezuelan operation from its consolidated financial reports, taking a $800 million pre-tax charge in the fourth quarter amid unstable economic conditions and additional currency devaluation, according to the Wall Street Journal. The charge is the second related to Venezuela for the last year, bringing the total impact above $1 billion in 2014. The fourth quarter hit is so large that it could lead Ford to post its first net loss since 2009. Venezuelan auto sales are modest, but the U.S. automaker operates a large factory in Venezuela, producing Fiesta small cars and Explorer SUVs. That's a look at business news on VOA Global. This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. Kenny G fans have something to celebrate. The biggest-selling instrumentalist in modern music, one of them anyway, and a saxophone great, now has a new CD out. And we're going to hear more from David Byrd coming up in his Now segment. But first, we're going to check in with the American Cafe and Ira Melman, who comes to us right now.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Even though the U.S. state of California has received a great deal of rain over the past week or so, scientists say it is far too little to even remotely alleviate that state's water deficit. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reports water experts, consumers, and farmers say California needs to make changes to cope with an uncertain future.
The fountains are dry at the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles, part of a statewide effort to save water. Californians are restricted in their outdoor watering, and those who defy the rules are subject to fines. The third consecutive year of drought has left some reservoirs at near record low levels, and the springtime snowpack, the source of much of the state's water, at just 20% of normal. Prices for California farm produce are rising, and farmers in the state's usually fertile Central Valley are letting fields lie fallow. Farmers blame conservation efforts in the Sacramento River Delta for diverting water away from their farms. Policy analyst Doug Parker of the California Institute for Water Resources at the University of California says the water system has failed to keep up with the state's needs. He says the California climate is becoming more variable and its water sources less stable.
What we do know from the climate change data is that we're going to get more droughts, and we're also going to have more flood-type years as well. So we need to be able to build a system and have a system that adapts to that variability in water.
Jeffrey Keitlinger of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California says his region and the rest of the state need to be smarter with water.
In the long run, local supplies, cleaning up our groundwater, recycling water, reclaiming water, that's the key to making Southern California sustainable.
Others say that California needs a comprehensive revamping of its water system that takes account of the growing need for water. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
George Pudich is in the cafe as well with a story involving water, but this involves turning water into fuel.
Natural gas and liquid fuels, burned in all kinds of internal combustion engines, are chemical compounds of hydrogen and carbon, coming mostly from underground reserves. But oceans are also huge reservoirs of hydrogen and increasingly carbon dioxide, or CO2. Dissolved in seawater from the air, it makes the water more acidic. Extracting those chemicals from the ocean and converting them into a form of liquid fuel was made possible by some recent technological advances, says U.S. Navy researcher Dr. Heather Willauer.
We've been actually able to show that we can recombine CO2 and hydrogen in the laboratory on a laboratory scale, into a liquid-type fuel.
The process requires a lot of electrical energy, which, to be economical, has to come from a cheap source, such as a nuclear power plant. Obviously, the most efficient place to do it would be aboard a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. Willauer says these ships may someday manufacture their own jet fuel.
Well, it is a game changer, potentially for the Navy or commercial entities, because you can make fuel potentially where and when you need it.
The new fuel was successfully tested on a model airplane with a two-stroke engine. For now, making it requires twice as much power than the fuel can produce, but researchers hope to lower that ratio. Willauer says the new process will not increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which contributes to global warming.
Once we've pulled it out of seawater, the ocean is ready to pull it back in from the atmosphere because it's in constant equilibrium. So what we hope is it's a carbon neutral footprint.
Scientists hope a small-scale industrial plant may start converting seawater into fuel within the next 15 years. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Join us on air and online at voanews.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Saxophonist Kenny G has a new CD out called Brazilian Nights that mixes traditional jazz arrangements with some of his own new tunes. Kenny G, one of the biggest selling instrumentalists in modern music, has long been regarded as a smooth jazz or an adult contemporary player. But he told the Associated Press that Brazilian Nights is an authentic jazz CD, and he did his homework to prepare for it.
But bossa nova was something I knew that I wanted it to work, because I really like the way bossa nova sounds. I like the way those old jazz masters were playing certain licks, certain runs, certain chord changes. I really love the way that sax sounds through that. So I thought, okay, I want to challenge myself to get this down.
Kenny has written 5 of the 10 tracks on the CD. Some of the others include bossa nova standards like Corcovado and The Girl from Ipanema. The 58-year-old musician says that he hopes that jazz radio stations will take his homage seriously and not let bias against him or his music keep his tracks off the air.
I think traditional jazz radio stations are going to play my music for once. They haven't yet. But I think if they don't play this, it's only because they must not like me and what they think I stand for, because I played these songs. This is traditional jazz. It's played very authentic, and I did my homework. So if they listen to it and go, ugh, then they're not listening to it. They're just looking at my face and just going, ugh, which is fine.
Kenny G told the AP that he hopes that satellite radio stations will put his music in their rotation alongside some of the jazz greats.
Yeah, I think they, and even on satellite radio and on the real jazz station, if they should play it. I'm sure they will. I mean, I can't imagine that they won't, but honestly, if they don't, I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. But I'd be kind of proud to watch my songs be played if I see, you know, Stan Getz and Miles Davis, and then you see my name coming up next on the playlist, because it deserves to be there, because that song is played in that style. I wouldn't expect them to play Songbird there. Wouldn't fit.
The Grammy Award-winning saxophonist says that he listens to old jazz albums all the time, but did not feel it necessary to travel to Brazil to immerse himself in the bossa nova tradition.
I didn't really need to be influenced, and I really still don't do a lot of listening. I mean, I might listen to the old school jazz guys because I just want to, I mean, that's good for technique, and I practice things like that a lot. But when it comes to writing and playing my music, I just kind of lock my door.
Brazilian Nights is Kenny G's 14th studio album and was co-written with his longtime collaborator, Walter Afanasiev. Kenny is also known for his 1989 tune, Going Home, being an unconventional mega hit in China. Many businesses piped the tune over their loudspeakers just before closing. Kenny also earned the ire of the Chinese government last year when he posted Twitter images of his visit to the Hong Kong protests. The musician later said that his impromptu visit to the protest site was, quote, just an innocent walk around Hong Kong. Kenny G describes himself as a perfectionist, and he doesn't take much criticism, even from other musicians. Still, the Seattle native says there are horizons he hasn't crossed, and he wants to explore other styles of music.
I love classical music. I love bossa nova. So I want to do records like that. I want to do another Christmas record. Is there anything else I want to do at this point? Not sure. Actually, I would like to do a real hardcore jazz record. Like, but not fast. Not, I want to do like jazz ballads, but really complicated changes.
So, are you a Kenny G fan? Do you have a favorite tune of his? Let us know by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd, and that's what's happening now. Well, a Michigan man driving around Ohio might have been better off listening to some Kenny G and chilling for a little bit. He got pulled over by police and figured he didn't want to be pulled over by the police. So he drove off and around the outside of the Toledo Correctional Institute, where he then smashed through a gate and ended up in the parking lot. Court records say that the young man, Jason Davis, was charged with vandalism of government property and, probably more important, failing to use a turn signal. His tires were deflated by spikes. We've got more deflation coming up in sports. Time for sports on VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson. Bill Belichick said the New England Patriots followed every rule in preparing their footballs for last Sunday's AFC Championship game, offering several potential reasons behind the Deflategate controversy that has followed his team during the last week. The Patriots head coach addressed the issue during an unscheduled availability on Saturday, one day after the NFL announced it has not drawn any conclusions yet how the team used underinflated footballs during the first half of its win against the Indianapolis Colts and then managed to earn its way into the Super Bowl. After detailing the organization's preparation process and suggesting that weather conditions may have affected the air pressure in the footballs, the longtime Patriots coach emotionally defended his team, saying, "We did everything as right as we can do it." He also said that he's learned more about the science of air pressure in the past week than he has from a lifetime around the game. Well, South African golfer Brandon Grace has won the Commercial Bank Cotter Masters in Doha. It's his second European Tour victory of the season. Nick Dye reports that Grace closed with a round of 66 for a 19-under-par total and a one-stroke win over Mark Warren of Scotland.
An eagle two at the 16th proved the game-changer as Grace added to his victory at Leopard Creek just prior to Christmas. An excellent approach enabled the gain, which pushed him clear of a field which had jockeyed for position all day.
You know, but today was good. You know, the first, you know, I started with a nice birdie and then the round didn't go really my way. And then, you know, just stuck to my routine, stuck to the guns. And, you know, the one thing led to another, one good swing led to the other one. And I made a couple of birdies coming in, which was a great bonus.
Warren had started and finished well, but Grace watched on as the Scot missed a tricky birdie putt at the last. Bernd Wiesberger had led, but he slipped to third spot.
I gave myself a bit too much work after the first three holes where I hit it a bit badly and came back nicely. I mean, I was leading then, but Gracie just pulled it off on the back nine, hit a couple of good putts.
Grace has now claimed six tour titles. All have come when he led or shared the lead at the end of round three. And four of them came in 2012, when he also started in such fashion. And he clearly hopes this is just the start of something spectacular. He's back inside the world's top 50, opening the door to all the big events.
Nick Dye reporting, and that's sports on VOA Global.
This is Science World Express. I'm Rick Pantaleo. A couple of million years ago, our ancient ancestors invented the world's first tools when they broke apart some rocks into sharp shards so that they could butcher their freshly captured game. Today, we hear from Dr. Thomas Morgan, lead author of a new study that suggests evolution not only helped ancient humans develop the tools, but that the invention of the tools also boosted the human evolutionary process. Can you give us a little bit of a background on the development of these butchering tools and how they were developed and why they were developed?
The earliest known tools are from about 2.5 million years ago, and they're the sorts of tools we were looking at in our study. The simplest ones are just called flakes, so they were made by striking a larger piece of certain types of rocks with a small hard hammer stone, and that would shatter off small pieces of rock called flakes that had very sharp edges. And these were just used to butcher the carcasses of dead animals quickly and effectively. So these tools are the dominant tool making for about 700,000 years until around 1.8 million years ago when the much more complicated Acheulean tools appear, and they're much more elaborate, much larger, and much more durable.
The ability to create tools can probably be linked to evolution. But the research conducted by you and your colleagues indicates that the creation of the tools also led to evolutionary changes. Could you tell us about this?
The traditional view was that so human evolution would have led to us having enhanced cognitive abilities, and with those abilities we could have worked out how to make these tools. But actually a more popular view today, and this is what we provide evidence for, is that actually it was the making of the tools themselves that generated the conditions that favored the evolution of complex forms of cognition. So in particular, we were looking at teaching and language. And we found that even these very early tools, the people learn them much more effectively if they have a teacher, particularly a teacher who can use language. And so what we're suggesting is that even 2.5 million years ago, reliance on these tools would have meant that there was an evolutionary advantage that would have started on the path towards the evolution of teaching and language. So these early tools, the fact that they are sort of the only tools available for around 700,000 years, suggests to us that during this period, the sort of communication that our ancestors could engage in was sufficiently limited that they couldn't share any sort of new ideas they had. So it might have been that our ancestors during this time were coming up with more elaborate ideas for tool making, but they weren't able to share them effectively with their group members, and so it never really took off. However, when we get to about 1.8 million years ago, when the new types of tools do take off, to us, that suggests that there must have been some sort of development in communication that allowed this to happen. And we suggest that this minimally involves some form of teaching. It's also plausible that it could be some very simple type of proto-language involving very basic concepts, so not a lot like a modern language that is very elaborate, but still, you know, a very early sort of precursor to modern language.
What kind of experiments were conducted?
So we conducted a study where we taught, it was just over 180 students from the University of St Andrews in Scotland. We taught them to make the older one flaked tools, so the oldest type of tools known. And what we did was we split the participants into five different groups, and we taught them in different ways. So in the simplest group, they received no teaching whatsoever. They just got to look at some tools that someone else had made and had to try and work it out for themselves. Another group was allowed to watch someone else making the tools, but they couldn't interact with them. And then in the more complex groups, they were being taught by someone, either through gestures in one case or through verbal language in another case. And what we did is, after the teaching, we then tested the participants to see how much the skill they had acquired. And what we saw was that actually, with just the sort of reverse engineering from someone else's tools but without interaction and just watching someone else make tools, was not a very effective way to share the knowledge of how to make these tools, but teaching, and in particular teaching with language, was incredibly effective.
So what do you hope people will be able to take away from your research and findings?
The big finding that I'm particularly excited about is the idea that human evolution, it's not just a story of our ancestors evolving in response to environmental conditions, but it's actually the case that we made those conditions ourselves. So this process is sometimes called gene culture coevolution, where our genes and our culture are evolving in response to each other in one single process. And to me, this idea that human culture was shaping human evolution across huge expanses of time, I find very exciting. Carrying out the experiment was obviously a really interesting experience, just watching all these students try their hand at making these tools, which is obviously something that most people never really get a chance to do.
That was Dr. Thomas Morgan from the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks for listening to Science World Express. Please visit us on the internet at voanews.com/science.
Every so often you find that you have a very large denomination bill in your pocket that you have to break someplace. And a man in Massachusetts had a $100 bill, and he got hungry. He wanted some lunch at a sandwich shop, so he decided to break the bill and buy a couple of lottery tickets. Well, that ended up being a good move, because the two lottery tickets that he just happened to buy to break his $100 bill ended up winning him $10 million. Lottery officials announced that Richard Knoll and his wife claimed the prize at lottery headquarters in Braintree, Massachusetts. He chose a one-time payment of $6.5 million after taxes. Not too bad. Says he wants to buy a house now, make a few investments, and take a trip to Walt Disney World. And take his granddaughter there. Sounds nice. Well, if you live in Eugene, Oregon, and you have not received your mail in a while, there's maybe a reason for it. A former U.S. Postal Service worker who failed to deliver nearly 1,000 pieces of mail has pleaded guilty to misdemeanor mail obstruction and been sentenced to a year of probation. The Register Guard newspaper says Alex Duma was also ordered to pay a $500 fine. Most of the mail was found last summer in two bins on his front porch. It was just junk mail for the most part, but there were also 27 voter ballots from last May's primary election, more than 200 items of first-class and standard mail. He had worked at the post office for a while, but said he just got a little bit lazy. Well, we've done our work, and that's the end of VOA Global for today. We thank you for listening and hope you join us again tomorrow, right here on the Voice of America.